a prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant, is unfit to be the ruler of a free people.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. On the night of December 16th, 1773, a group of men dressed as Native Americans snuck aboard the Dartmouth, a British merchant ship that had just arrived in Boston Harbor, carrying a major shipment of tea. These natives, who were in fact members of the Sons of Liberty, threw 342 chests of the East India Company's tea into the freezing waters of Boston Harbor. We remember this event as the Boston Tea Party, an event that helped set off the War of Independence against King George, a British tyrant who, in the words of the Declaration, was no longer fit to be the ruler of a free people. So what is the connection between American independence and tea, a commodity grown on the other side of the world in India? What was the East India Company? And why was it so important in shaping the events that led to the American Revolution? And what did the colonists think about the British Empire in India and the tea trade in general? Here with me today to discuss tea, tyranny, and the East India Company is Professor Jonathan Eckett. Jonathan is Associate Professor of History at the University of California, Riverside. His research focuses on the British and their empire from the 18th century to the present. His first book, Selling Empire, India in the Making of Britain and America, 1600 to 1830, won the World History Association Bentley Book Prize. A link is in the show notes. So, Jonathan, let's start by unpacking that phrase that you chose to start the episode, a prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant, is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. That word tyrant is capitalized in there, so it seems to have some great effect there in the Declaration, yeah?
Yes, and what I'd like to focus on is how the context was different for the colonists than what it is for us today when they thought of this word. So for them, they connected tyrants or tyranny very much with Asia and with the rulers of Asia. So when they were writing this word, they wouldn't have been thinking just about King George. They would have been thinking about rulers that they had a vague knowledge of, but much more this long history in England of thinking of rulers in Asia as tyrants.
Can you just expand on some of those specific examples from where and which kind of rulers, who maybe, any specifics? Are we talking about Genghis Khan and like, I don't know, some mandarins in China?
They would have had some of that in their heads, but I think they were mostly thinking about the Mughal Empire. And that was where they had their closest connections. And so, and they would think about a variety of different rulers in parts of Southeast Asia and Asia. But it was the Mughals that they kind of knew the best. And so that's because of their trade with India. They focused their trade in the 17th and 18th centuries much more heavily on India than on China. And tea actually comes fairly late in popularity compared to the other goods that they were trading. So they were trading spices, cinnamon, pepper, and most importantly, cotton cloth. And so those were the things that mostly came from India, from the Mughal Empire. And so that's why when they thought of tyranny, they would often really think in those terms.
And what exactly did tyranny mean for them from a political perspective?
That's a great question. And it's easy to oversimplify this. And of course, there was lots of different opinions and different views. But one of the things that really connected a lot of the colonists and people in England was their sense that freedom meant being Protestant. And freedom meant having a English-style constitutional monarchy. And so if the people weren't Protestant, and if they didn't have some sort of constitutional restraints on the ruler, then they saw those people as living under tyranny of one form or another, and of their rulers as being tyrants, or tyrants. So that's really how they thought about the difference between themselves and other people. And so it wasn't just even about Asian rulers. They would combine into this, of course, people living in France who they saw living under a popish rule. And they would say, oh, well, they're Catholic. And so then they're not free. They don't have the freedom that we have as Protestants. So that was a very large part. So they would associate sort of Catholic people, Muslim people, Hindu people, all collectively as living under tyranny.
But the worst were then these Asian tyrants, just because, I guess, I'm just sensing maybe a little bit of racism in there, or maybe a lot of racism in there.
Yeah, there's definitely proto-racism or early forms of racism, and there's also a strong sense that the further away you get from Protestantism, the worse it is. And so Catholics were at least Christian, but Muslims and Hindus were something else entirely.
I'm just going to throw this out there. It's a weird question. Did black Africans suffer from tyranny in the same way they thought that Indians under the Mughal Empire?
They're generally less familiar with the political systems of Africa. They're much more familiar with the political systems of Asia, and I think it was easier for them to see similarities from a civilizational perspective, for lack of a better word. They associated themselves more readily with the peoples of Asia than with the peoples of Africa, who they saw in a racial hierarchy further beneath them. And of course, there were a few people already seeing their own treatment, American treatment of African people, as tyrannical. But for the most part, they didn't make that connection. But people were starting to make that connection immediately before the American Revolution. And there has been some work that suggested that, recent work that suggests that that also contributes to revolutionary sentiment, is fears of what's happening in Britain in abolitionism coming to America, which would really destabilize much of the American economy, which was based so much on enslaved labor.
And I just want to stand this concept of a free people, because it came up in our discussion of Canada and the letters to the oppressed people of Canada. And sort of one of the great intelligence failures or political misunderstandings of the invasion of Canada and these letters to the oppressed inhabitants of Canada. And I think it's something we see throughout American history. When Americans tell other people they're not free, you know, those people are like, well, it's not a big issue to us. Like, don't put your concepts of freedom on us. And of course, the French Canadians did not join the revolution. They essentially sided with the Protestant king. But I think it's important just to stress the fact that at this time, there were different concepts of being free. It was different for a French Canadian. It was different for a Spanish citizen of Spanish Florida. And in fact, we might add that an African-American enslaved person who fled, say, the Carolinas south to Spanish Florida and would be freed would say, well, you know, there's no freedom for me in the colonies, but as now a Spanish citizen in Florida who's pledged allegiance to the King of Spain and the Pope, now I'm a free person.
And the Quebec Act, which you've sort of alluded to by talking about Quebec, is another important touchstone in thinking about the Declaration of Independence and tyranny, because they perceived the Quebec Act, which was providing quite a bit of toleration to Catholicism in Quebec. Protestant colonists in the other 13 colonies saw that as very dangerous. They were really afraid that if the British government was going to tolerate Catholicism and accept it, which I think a lot of people today might see as offering more freedom to people in Quebec, people in the 13 colonies saw that as a potential infringement on their own freedoms, because, again, they associated Catholicism very much with tyranny, not with freedom. And so if the British were going to allow their new colony of Quebec to be Catholic, that looked dangerous. And it got worse, because not only did they allow that Catholicism in Quebec from the Patriot perspective, it got worse, I should say. They also eventually gave Quebec the rights to the Ohio River Valley, which blocked off Pennsylvania and other colonies from expanding inland like they wanted to. And so Quebec almost becomes privileged in that way. And that was largely because the British government expected the Quebec government and the Quebec people to have better relations with the indigenous peoples of the Ohio Valley. And they wanted to preserve those relations instead of allowing people from Pennsylvania elsewhere to sort of move across and displace all those peoples.
Right. Good. So I want to take the story now actually over the Pacific, or however you want to get there, over the Atlantic, all the way to India. Obviously, I started the episode by talking about the Boston Tea Party. Tea is such a huge part of the story of the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence, but the only way of understanding tea, we have to understand the Mughal Empire, we have to understand the East India Company and all that stuff. So yeah, just explain that, please.
Give me a second to decide where to start here.
All right.
So most Americans can tell the story of the Boston Tea Party. And I think there's large agreement of seeing it as triggering the revolution. But a lot of myths have built up around why the Tea Party happened. And when I ask my students, and I teach a variety of classes here at Riverside, one of them has 500 students, a big world history course that covers this time period. I have a big sample size. When I ask them, what did the Tea Act do? Almost all of them are convinced that it raised the taxes on tea. In fact, the Tea Act did the exact opposite. It lowered the tax on tea. And so I think our question around the Tea Act and the Boston Tea Party and why it sort of triggers revolution is often kind of backwards. We sort of think, a lot of people sort of think of it in terms of, you know, people revolting over higher taxes, but we should be asking, why did they revolt over lower taxes? And they'd had a lot of opportunities to revolt over higher taxes. So I think a lot of textbooks use what I call like a cumulative grievance theory of the American Revolution. So you have, you know, the Stamp Act, the Townshend duties, these sort of accumulated grievances that typically have to do with increasing taxation. But people don't revolt. They don't take up arms over any of those acts. What triggers the acts that make them fight is the Tea Act, and it lowers tea taxes. So I think the real puzzle is, why does the revolution start over the lowering of taxes and not over the increasing of taxes?
Okay. That's kind of telling the story right before for the onset of this, but can you just go back maybe before we get there and talk about the origins of trade with India, the British Empire, the East India Company going to and setting up in India, and the creation of this commodity mercantile system where they're growing tea in India and transporting it all over the world, including to the colonies.
And I think that history is essential to answering that question about why have a revolution over lowering taxes instead of when they had chances to revolt over increasing taxes. So we could start, we've already opened a little bit with the discussion of the trade and how that starts is very early in the 17th century, at the same time that England is colonizing in North America and in the Caribbean. It is sending out expeditions of ships to Asia, and primarily going, as I said, to get spices and pepper at first, and then they realize cotton cloth would be a very valuable commodity, and they market it quite heavily. And I think if your listeners look in their closets, they know why. You know, cotton cloth today is a very common fabric because it's easy to care for, it looks good, it washes very easily. It's very easy to color it in all different kinds of ways. So it's a very attractive product. And it hadn't existed really almost at all in Europe before this point. And so it explodes on the market. And in the process of that growing popularity, it starts to displace domestically produced fabrics, like woolen in particular. And so, you know, again, if your listeners look in their closet, they probably have a lot more cotton there than they have wool. So this wasn't an unfounded fear, but it was definitely a very politically powerful fear as well. And so the parliament in Britain decides to ban most forms of Indian cotton cloth. And so they allow plain white cloth to come through and a few other things, but most of the stuff that's very fashionable is banned. But they do not ban the cloth in the American colonies. And so one of the things about the Tea Act is that it's a way to prop up the East India Company, to increase the sale of tea, which is why the tax is lowered. It's to increase the sale of tea in the colonies. And this is actually following a pattern that the Parliament had already come up with early in the 18th century with cotton, using the colonies as a market or even as a dumping ground for cotton cloth, a way to profit from consumption in their colonies. And the other thing they did with the cotton cloth, and even more of the cotton cloth, vast quantities of cotton cloth were shipped to Africa in exchange for enslaved African people. And those people, of course, were then brought to the American colonies for their labor. And so cotton cloth was fundamental to colonization and the colonial economies in North America and the Caribbean. And all of that cloth, before the Industrial Revolution, because it hasn't happened yet, all of that cloth came from India. And it is huge, huge quantities of it. This is a very, very valuable trade. And so the company itself is very valuable. Its products are valuable, and it's a joint stock company like the companies we have today. People invested in it, and so people had a vested interest in the company being successful. The company also loaned money and gave money to the government. So the government had a vested interest in the company being successful.
The cotton cloth story here is not one that is often discussed in relation to the American independence, because we're so focused on tea for all the incorrect or false reasons, as you were saying. The Boston Tea Party was a protest against the Tea Act, which lowered the taxes on tea, not increased it. So that's good for us to clarify. But the cotton part of the story is something that's new to me, too. And then I'm just beginning to see, and we're not going to talk about this because this has to do with the Civil War and industrialization and the cotton industry in the South that was developed later. But I do want to see now, so I understand the cotton industry and how that was developed, but I'm still interested in the tea trade. So how do we get from cotton to tea to the colonies?
So the East India Company's always looking for more revenue opportunities. And tea had been imported since the 17th century. But when the bans are placed on cotton, the pressure is obviously even greater to find more commodities. What else can we bring in greater quantity to offset the loss of that cotton market in Britain itself? And so tea is something they identify as, let's bring more of that. And tea, in some ways, a little bit trickier for them than cotton, because they have to go further. They have to go all the way to China. And the tea is not coming from India in this period. It's coming from China. It won't be until the 19th century that the British actually create large tea plantations in India. And so for the 18th century, for the period we're talking about, the tea is coming almost entirely from China. And it has taken some of the place of the cotton cloth. And so around 1740, 1750, we start to see tea become a really dominant commodity for the company. And before that, there had been no question that it was always cotton. But by the middle of the 18th century, now we can start to see tea becoming much, much more valuable and in much greater quantities. The problem, of course, is that they tend to oversaturate the market. It's possible to bring too much tea. And so the price of tea in London fluctuates a lot, which can cause great loss for the company. And this is where that idea of getting more tea into the colonies comes from.
Fascinating. And the colonists were, by and large, happy consumers of tea, yes?
They were happy consumers of everything. So one thing about that one strand that is connected from the colonists, I think, right forward to the present is the United States has been a consumer society long before it was the United States. And so they were eager consumers of anything they could get from all over the world. They loved the cotton cloth. They loved porcelain from China. And they also loved tea. And so the empire was working well for them in the sense that it was bringing them all this stuff, but they were also bargain hunters, and so they wanted the best prices. And when it came to tea, the best prices didn't always come from the East India Company. And so several colonists, some of them very famous, like John Hancock, were big tea smugglers. And so they would smuggle tea from the Dutch. And that was to avoid the taxes and duties on tea that were applied to the East India Company's tea in Britain. And so the Tea Act lowers those duties to discourage people from buying tea from the smugglers and instead to buy the legal tea. And so from Parliament's perspective, it's better for people to buy the legal tea at a lower tax rate than to buy the illegal tea at a zero tax rate.
I can't remember which of the founders it was. It was James Madison, maybe, or John Adams, who said, who served a guest tea. And he's like, well, here's some tea. I really like drinking it. I believe it's smuggled tea, so don't worry about it. We're not violating, you know, our own idea of boycotting English tea.
Yes, exactly.
That's great. The other thing Americans maybe historically like doing is avoiding taxes. But that's another story. Okay, so I'm beginning to understand this very complex global network of trade. We've got the Dutch involved in the Dutch tea trade, and the Dutch are smuggling, and, you know, you can get tea in Philadelphia, and it's relabeled, so they're avoiding taxes. And we've discussed St. Eustatius and other of these Dutch colonies in other episodes. And so we've got the smuggling. We've got these huge trade networks. We've got ships going back and forth. We've got privateers going back and forth. And of course, we also have global wars happening. The Seven Years' War, also known as the French and Indian War in North America. And so what is this doing in general to this very complex network of trade that goes from China and India all the way to Britain and then over the Atlantic? What's going on, and how do we continue telling the story of tea here, the East India Company, in the context of the Seven Years' War?
Through the Seven Years' War is how tea gets connected even more firmly to tyranny. So I like that you mentioned both names for the Seven Years' War, because I think in the United States, there's a tendency to look at it as a very North American phenomenon. But it was a fully global war. And there are historians who call it the first global war. There's no question that it was a global war. And of course, we've already talked about the British Empire gains New France and Quebec out of this war. That's the most famous part in North America. But that's not a particularly valuable colony. Apologies to people in Canada today, but at the time, it wasn't particularly valuable. It was fairly lightly populated, and it didn't have any super valuable products. There was no gold mines or silver mines. There was nothing that was extremely valuable there. In contrast, if we go around the world to Asia, at the same time that the British were conquering Quebec, they were conquering a place called Bengal. And Bengal is, at the time, one of the wealthiest places in the world because it is the largest producer of cotton cloth and a massive producer of rice. And so these two commodities, rice and cotton cloth, really drive a robust economy in Bengal. There's millions of people that live there, a much, much larger population than there is in New France. And it's a remarkable story that Britain conquers this place. The Mughal Empire had successfully resisted conquest by Europeans for hundreds of years by this point. But you know, there's a long story here. I won't tell the whole story. But the kind of important piece of this for what we're thinking about, the British will effectively kind of use their own troops, but also large numbers of Indian troops, to secure victory at a battle called the Battle of Plassey. And this battle is not very well known in the United States today, but in the 1760s and early 1770s, it was very well known in the American colonies. And what happens after the battle becomes even more well known. And the reason we can know this is from colonial newspapers, because there's an explosion of colonial print and newspapers in the middle of the 18th century, and there's so many of them. And they've all been digitized, which is amazing. It was great for my research, and so I could search this. And I realized that India was a major topic of conversation for colonists in these newspapers. And they were fascinated by what was happening there. But the story got very, very bad very quickly. Because the East India Company was a corporation, its interests were in increasing the value of its stock for its shareholders. But once it conquered Bengal, it had also become a government. And so this is a very, I think in general, this is a very scary proposition, is for a people to be governed by a corporation. A corporation that's main goal is to generate revenue and stock price increases for people on the other side of the world. So when there's a famine in Bengal, which is not an unusual thing to happen, and the East India Company doesn't cause crop failure, but when there is a crop failure in the late 1760s, under East India Company rule in Bengal, the company sees an opportunity to increase profit and revenue. Because if food is in short supply, the value of food goes up. So if you hold it back from the market, you can increase its value. And so while they're not doing anything to solve the problem, they're not bringing more food because they like the cost of food being high, they're at the same time aggressively collecting their taxes because their goal is always to get that revenue. And so they're aggressively collecting land tax, basically, from people who can no longer afford to pay it because they can't afford to eat. And so they make a hazard, a food shortage, into a massive famine and disaster. And we don't know how many people exactly die, but it's millions. It's millions of people die from famine under the East India Company's rule. And this was huge and terrifying news in England, but also in the American colonies. And their newspapers were full, week to week, column after column, describing the trauma inflicted on the Bengali people by the East India Company.
What struck me about the awareness in the colonies of this terrible famine halfway around the world, it also resonates with some of the other, I guess, early consumer behavior that we see in the colonies. The awareness, for example, that rum is made by slaves, enslaved people in terrible conditions, and that maybe when they're drinking that rum, certainly abolitionists would remind them, you know, you really like drinking your rum, but remember that rum is being made under horrible conditions. So this idea, I guess we would call it now ethical consumerism now, is actually quite a very old idea. It goes back at least to this time. I'd realized it about the commodity of rum and slavery, but it's interesting that they're also aware of this famine half a world away.
Right, and the way that they're going to connect it is a little bit different, because it's not that they're super concerned about the ethical questions of the production of tea, because a lot of this tea is coming from China and not from Bengal. So they have some sense of that. They're much more concerned about the political implications of what's happening in Bengal, because this is happening and the news is filtering back into the colonial newspapers in the early 1770s. And part of the reason that the colonists are needed to prop up the East India Company is because the famine is devastating to the East India Company's finances. initially it's okay, but then they can't extract the tax once the tax base dies. And so it's very harsh. That's their reality. In trying so hard to generate revenue so fast out of people and increasing the risk of those people dying, they've created real long-term damage, of course, to Bengal, but to their own economic prospects. And the East India Company was far more valuable to Parliament than the Atlantic colonies. Just to give you a sense of that, the British government brings in about 10 times more revenue in the late 1760s from the East India Company than from all of the colonies in North America and the Caribbean. And so it's just it's far more tax revenue that comes from Bengal than comes from the 13 colonies. And so they have extreme pressure to maintain that. It's not possible. And so the company is in severe danger of failing, which would be disastrous for all of its stockholders, for the British government. And so they need a way to keep it going. And that's where the Tea Act comes in. And this is not a secret to the colonists at the time. I think it's become forgotten in a lot of the narratives about the American Revolution, but it definitely wasn't a secret to them at the time. And they very carefully connected the famine and the disastrous East India Company government in Bengal to their supposed to be new role as the consumers of the East India Company's tea to save it from collapse. When I think a lot of them would prefer that it collapsed, and they're going to be supposed to be used as the people to save what they see as something that shouldn't be saved, a corporation, first of all, that's a monopoly that they don't like, and second of all, that has become a tyrannical government.
This thread that we're following from the East India Company is fascinating, and I'm beginning to get a good sense of this picture of the importance of the political understanding of this corporation, the tea trade, and India. Now, as all of this is happening in Bengal, we have this global war going on that is also taking place in the colonies. So what does the Seven Years' War have to do with all this? And my sense is, this is my hypothesis, I don't know about this, my sense is that the British Empire, being on the one hand under threat financially from the potential collapse of the East India Company, huge revenue disaster, plus going in debt because of the Seven Years' War, is facing a financial crisis, and that's how these strands might start coming together.
Exactly. And the goal for those cumulative grievance acts, right, the Stamp Act and the Townshend Duties, those that do try to raise taxes on the colonies, it's fascinating because they actually aren't trying to generate a lot of revenue. There isn't a sense that the colonists can be a source of massive revenue like India is. There isn't that expectation. But they're also very frustrated that there's lots of colonists that are smuggling, that there doesn't seem to be real dedication amongst the officials in the colonies to upholding the imperial regulations. And so the Stamp Act is designed to help generate funds to pay for a standing military force in the colonies. And yet there isn't really a need for a standing military force in the colonies anymore after the Seven Years' War. The threat from France is basically gone. And so colonists see that, well, why are you trying to put an army here when we don't need one? And the colonists had been a very successful militia force in the Seven Years' War. And so the British government had already solved their sort of defense of the colonies problem. They had paid for colonial militia, and they had defeated the French presence that was most threatening. And so there seemed to be, like, why would we need this standing army anymore? And that's the kind of thing that you might have in a place like India. So it looks bad. And at the same time, the Townshend duties that follow, they're not designed to pay for an army, but they are designed to shift who pays the tax collectors and who pays those customs collectors, so that they will be paid. The money will come from the colonies to Parliament, and then Parliament will pay these collectors themselves. And by doing this, by shifting who pays the officials, Parliament is expecting the officials to be much more dedicated to serving Parliament's interests and not the interests of the colonists. And so these acts, I think a lot of the time they're looked at as being about taxation, but the grievances, and if you kind of look at the long list of grievances in the Declaration of Independence, there's really only one of those that's about taxes specifically. Most of the grievances have a lot more to do with how the empire is administered and what the rights of the colonists are to make their own decisions. And those rights seem to be under threat. And when they look across the world to India, they see a place in which those rights don't exist. And they see that the East India Company acts like the same kind of tyrant that they imagine the Mughal Empire or other Asian rulers acting like.
In your discussion there, you mentioned pretty clearly two specific grievances. Grievance number 11, he has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. This is the story you told of the, I think it was about 10,000 British regulars stationed in the U.S. or, you know, some Sons of Liberty might call it a military occupation, right? Because there's no war, there's no reason to have a standing army. And the other one you were referring to, I believe, is number 10. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Is that referring then tax collectors?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, fascinating. Good. Okay, so as we're getting now from the Seven Years' War to this period of all of these new acts, the Stamp Acts, the Townshend Duties, etc., we're slowly making our way to the outbreak of conflict. And maybe it's time now that we can go back to Boston the night of December 16th, 1773, and now relive that story knowing all this context. So why don't you start drawing together some of these different contexts for us and the Boston Tea Party?
And to do that, I'd like to turn to some of the Patriot authors at the time. And I think they can tell the story here and make the connection for us. And one of those people wrote under the name Hampden. I'm not sure exactly who Hampden was, but Hampden produced a five-part leaflet series. There's quite a few examples of this surviving. So I think it was a fairly well-distributed leaflet series, and it was called The Alarm. And Hampden was setting off the alarm for his fellow colonists about what the tea act and the tea being brought to the colonies represented. And so, it's five different leaflets that he produced, and they all draw strong connections between tea, tyranny, the East India Company, and what he sees is about to happen in the colony. So I'll just read you a quote. So you know, and I like to tell my students this, that I like to read the quotation so you know it's not just me saying this. There's people at the time very clearly identifying these connections. So I'll just read you here a little bit from The Alarm. Parliament used the Tea Act to support the tyranny of the East India Company in the East, enslave the West, and prepare us fit victims for the exercise of that horrid inhumanity they have in such dread abundance and with more than savage cruelty practiced on the helpless Asiatics. And so, yeah, Hampden's warning his fellow colonists, the tyranny of the East India Company is being brought to us. And John Dickinson, a very famous writer, patriot writer from the late 1760s and early 1770s, wrote in 1773, "Thank God we are not sepoys nor Maharadas, but British subjects who are born to liberty, who know its worth, and who prize it high." So the basic message here is, unlike the people of India or Bengal, American patriots will know better than to accept this tyranny, that they will fight back, that they value their own freedom and how they define freedom. And so these are the kind of messages being sent at the moment of the Tea Act and as the tea's arriving in Boston to the American colonists by other American colonists. And they're drawing that line that we've been talking about very, very directly between the East India Company's behavior in Bengal and what is about to happen in America.
Just because you started this by talking about the fact that everyone gets it wrong, the interpretation that the chests of tea were thrown into Boston Harbor because of the Tea Act, and people falsely think that it was because it increased taxes on tea when in fact it lowered it. Thinking about that act, and as the common person would interpret it at the time, what did it really represent to your average person in Boston? I mean, was it really anything about the tea itself? Was it just a symbolic thing? I mean, of course, people have talked a lot about the fact that they've dressed up as Native Americans. I mean, can you just kind of unpack what's really going on to an observer at the time, say someone sitting on the fence about all of these, who's just like, okay, well, I just read that all these Native Americans, not Native Americans, have thrown all this tea into the harbor. I mean, what are they thinking then?
That's a great question. It's hard for historians to know for sure. We think probably about a third of colonists were patriots and were fairly fired up by this point. Probably another third thought this was all ludicrous. They looked at the arguments being made by people like the Alarm and John Dickinson and said, look, Parliament's not going to do that to us because we're not sepoys or Marauders. We're Protestant. We're English. They're not going to do those things to us that they've done in India. And so, you know, you're blowing this way out of proportion. And the East India Company is never going to rule us. I mean, the Alarm has large sections about how the East India Company is going to come to rule us. And, you know, they just think that's never going to happen. And then there's probably another third of the colonists who just are trying to lay as low as possible and don't really want to engage with this. You know, they're trying to live their lives and certainly don't look forward to going to any kind of conflict, a military conflict, with the rest of the empire. So I think there's definitely a variety of different viewpoints, and the patriots are definitely not the only one. There's a good chance they're not even a majority. Probably the people keeping their heads down and the more loyal colonists probably form a majority combined. And the patriots on their own might be a plurality. So it's what happens in response, though, that definitely galvanizes more people. Still may not even be a majority, but certainly galvanizes more people to the patriot side. Because...
So wait, before you go on to the response, I mean, basically, are lots of people just thinking that this is a stupid prank? You know, no one's dying. They're going on there. They're throwing a bunch of tea in the harbor. Okay, you know, maybe it's going slightly overboard, but they're not going in and executing sailors on the ship or anything, you know. And they're not, like, torpedoing the ship itself.
Right.
A political stunt, maybe I'd call it.
Yes, and definitely lots of people see it that way. The problem it presents for the British Parliament, though, is that it is destroying valuable property, and it is directly repudiating parliamentary law. And so it is seen as a rebellious act because property is sacrosanct in the British Empire. And that's one of the freedoms that Protestants also sort of align together with their sense of what is freedom in Britain. And private property as something that must be protected was a large part of that identity. So for politicians in Britain, this is a direct challenge. So it may look like a prank to some people, but to other people, it looks like a real declaration of rebellion.
Okay, and so then, given these various viewpoints about it, it doesn't necessarily need to be. It's not violent in the sense of human life. But you said what really starts to turn the, let's say, those who are sitting on the fence more in the direction of the patriot side is the overreaction to this, or I guess what we would call, good American patriots would call, overreaction. But there was a reaction.
And I think, you know, it looked like an overreaction too to people in Britain. Again, there's lots of people in Britain who support the patriots, who really see their own government as deeply problematic. And there's a lot of people in Britain who see the East India Company as deeply problematic, and certainly what's happened in Bengal as disastrous and unfitting of British people. And over the next several decades, there'll be multiple long investigations and impeachments in Parliament over East India Company officials and operations. And so, you know, there's a lot of shared grievance with the colonists. But the Parliament, the government, reacts exactly how I think Dickinson and Hampden were telling everyone to be afraid of. And so they do probably the worst possible thing they could do if their goal is to keep this empire together. And they pass a series of what have been called the Intolerable Acts. And the Intolerable Acts are really referred to indirectly in a lot of the grievances that are listed. So what do they do with these Intolerable Acts? I mean, most gallingly to many of the patriots and to other colonists, the colonial elected governing body is not simply dissolved, that had happened before, but it's basically completely put on ice. It will have no more significance or existence for the foreseeable future. And so the colonists of Massachusetts have lost their elected assembly, which is seen as absolutely essential to their constitution and to the English constitution. Right, that's one of when I very first started describing Protestantism and constitutional monarchy. And that sort of democratic piece is seen as absolutely essential to protecting their rights. And that is removed. That is taken from them. And at the same time, the Intolerable Acts also remove the colonists' power to appoint their own officers, their own legal judges. So they no longer are using peers or their own peers to judge each other. The town meetings that Massachusetts was famous for are very strictly reduced and constrained. And so all of these things make the British administration and government of Massachusetts look like the administration and governments of Bengal. It really did smack of tyranny, and it really did. You know, Bengal did not have any elected assemblies. Bengal did not have any free ports for British merchants, and Massachusetts would no longer have an open port. It was being blocked from trade, even more draconian than the monopoly ports in India. Bengal did not have any locally raised and appointed officials. They were always kind of overlords. There were no democratic town meetings or assemblies that had any power or substance in Bengal. And so it really was doing what Hampden was so alarmed would happen. It was making Massachusetts government and administration look like the government and function like the government and administration of Bengal. And so, you know, again, it's looking at it, it's hard to imagine the British government doing a worse job of trying to reduce tension. And of course, that's not really their goal. Their goal is to fully control Massachusetts, which, of course, backfires because many other colonists now see this in other colonies and say, if you're going to do that to Massachusetts, there really is nothing stopping you from doing that everywhere. And we will lose all of our rights and all of our freedoms. And you really are tyrants.
This has been so fascinating. And the way you've tied together all of these different issues about the East India Company, what's going on in Bengal, the cotton industry, the tea consumption, tea taxes, the Boston Tea Party, now the Intolerable Acts. And then when I now look at this phrase that we started with from the Declaration of Independence, a prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Well, for me, the two key phrases there are a tyrant, right? And now we get the sense of tyranny, the way that the East India Company, under King George, has totally ravaged the poor people of Bengal. And then this free people comment is so, well, it's self-evident, as the Declaration of Independence says, these things are self-evident. We are a free people. You cannot treat us like other unfree people out there on the other side of the sea, in Africa and other places. We are, as you've been saying all along, we are Protestant. We have the rights under constitutional monarchy. We will not be treated as victims of a tyrant. Thank you for unpacking that terrific phrase for me today. Now, do you want to make any final comments about that phrase before we conclude?
I'd like to let two more Patriot writers make some comments. And one of them makes the connection here with Quebec that we had talked about before. And it really follows on about what you were just saying as well about how they perceive themselves as free people, unlike other people. And this patriot was writing about the Quebec Act and saying that the people of Quebec as Catholics were, and this is a quote, as much slaves as the inhabitants of France or Turkey. And so again, making that very specific connection, and that the Quebec Act, and this is another direct quote, was intended to prepare the way for universal despotism in the British Empire. I'll leave you with another one here too. And this one is a little awkwardly phrased, but it's great because it wasn't just a quotation. It was actually a very popular series of prints that were produced in the early 1770s of King George III wearing a turban and a big Asian robe. And it came with different names. It was titled in different ways. It was a few different varieties of this. But it literally portrayed George III as a Mughal emperor, as what they perceived as an Asian tyrant. So there was a quote that circulated as well, and it didn't go along with the picture. The picture existed separately from this. And it was a fake quotation. So we think about fake news today. One patriot wrote a quotation and attributed it to George III, but it wasn't George III. It was fake. But he admitted that it was fake. So, you know, yes, there was this fake quotation. George III said this. And then he didn't actually say that. But went on to say, and this is another quote, "We have fairly clothed an Eastern spirit." This is here referring to George III as an Eastern spirit. He's no longer Western. He's no longer an Englishman. He's an Eastern spirit. "We have fairly clothed an Eastern spirit in an Eastern garb." And so we kind of started talking about cotton today, and here they've this symbolism of dressing George III, whether in a picture or in a quotation, as a Mughal ruler, was again very, very powerful. And that's another kind of way that we can see when they said tyrant, when they said tyranny and tyrant, this is what they were thinking of.
It's such a wonderful global context that you've given today. And it's great that we can connect the ideas of the patriots in North America to all of these other global events, from consumption of their tea and cotton to politics. But we've come to the end of our discussion today, Jonathan. And I ask all my guests, here we are at the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. You're a historian, specialist in Bengal, early America. What are your big takeaways looking back 250 years in the past?
I don't think it's a particularly new comment, but it's clear that we are in the United States continuing to struggle with the relationship between despotism and freedom, not only globally, but within our own borders. And I think that looking back to this history, we can see that the Patriots were already heavily involved in global thinking, that they weren't isolationist at all. They were very tuned into what was happening in the rest of the British Empire, in the rest of the world. They had a very clear sense of what they were afraid of. And some of those fears were racially motivated. Some of those fears were motivated by religion. And some of those fears were motivated by losses of freedom that they were really concerned they were going to face in what seemed to be a very changing British Empire. So I think the old stories about taxation, they have their place, but I think it's more valuable maybe for us to start thinking more about all of these other concerns that patriots had about the infringements on their rights, about great fear of monopoly and monopoly corporations. They were deeply, deeply afraid of monopoly corporations, not only because of the East India Company, but that was the most frightening example that they saw. But it wasn't the only monopoly company around. There was also the Hudson's Bay Company that was closer to home and could conceivably become a problem. And they were very afraid of corporate power. So this is a terrific moment for us to rethink all of the list of grievances in the Declaration of Independence and direct our focus maybe a little less to taxation, which again wasn't such a big part of the list. But think about why that list of grievances was so long and about what the specific grievances were more carefully. And these grievances really do collect around questions of fear of losing rights of representation, rights to make choices for themselves as colonists, rights to trade as they wanted to trade with the rest of the world, and rights to avoid corporate power and the kind of monopolies that they really feared. So I think if we stop thinking so much about taxation, we're going to get a much bigger, much more important sense of what really motivated those colonists and of maybe issues that can help to motivate us today. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americanzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americanzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americanzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.